I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Dennis Olin trial has gripped people across Canada, and more so in St. John, New Brunswick, where the Olin family is third only to the Irvings and McCains when it comes to prominence. Dennis Olin was found guilty of second-degree murder in the 2011 death of his father, businessman Richard Olin. The trial would be the most publicized in New Brunswick history, lengthy and costly to boot. It had all the elements of a compelling saga: adultery, family dysfunction, money, police incompetence, high-priced lawyers, and evidence that was often circumstantial than clear-cut. Joining me now is the author Greg Marquis, an academic who has followed this case closely and whose new book is an ideal subject for a chat, what with the news last week that Richard Olin's conviction was overturned following an appellate court's ruling that the trial judge had erred in instructing the jury on a matter of evidence. I'll get Mr. Marquis to tell us about the latest on this fascinating saga and his book, Truth and Honor, The Death of Richard Olin and the Trial of Dennis Olin. Greg Marquis is a professor of history at the University of New Brunswick, St. John. He is the author of previous books, Policing Canada's Century, Armageddon Shadow, and The Vigilant Eye. This new book is published by Nimbus. Please welcome to the Plante Online program in St. John, New Brunswick today, Greg Marquis. Professor Marquis, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So when was Dennis originally convicted? That was, I guess, a year and a half ago
or so? December, the jury came down with its verdict on December 19th, 2015.
Okay, so then right after that, so about a year or so, less than a year ago, and then I guess in January of this year, he appeals the ruling, right?
He filed his appeal. You have to file an appeal within 30 days, so he filed the appeal of the conviction, and then they also filed a bail appeal to try to get see if he could be released on bail pending his appeal. So there are two things that play over the winter and summer and fall. Yeah.
And then so now this news last week that the conviction was overturned and that he is to get a second trial. Did that surprise a lot of people? I guess it surprised a lot of people that he got convicted in the first place, right?
Yes, at the time. I guess, as I explained in the book, I was part of that wave of surprise. But if you read the book, I try to then go back and unpack it and take another look at what may have happened with the jury.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the appeal, last week was the thing in the Supreme Court matter in Ottawa. I think it was actually the week before that when the appeal was announced, the Monday before that. But that I wasn't surprised that a new trial was ordered, because I attended the New Brunswick Court of Appeal in Fredericton the previous week, and I thought at the end of that week it could go in either way, right? And so some media outlets said, you know, shocking news that the conviction wasn't acquitted, but you know the conviction was overturned and he has to stand a new trial. I wasn't surprised. To me, it was a flip of a coin.
Yeah, I think you do such a great job at the beginning of your book in terms of setting the scene of where we're talking about. Because for someone like me, I've lived in Vancouver my whole life. I've never ventured anywhere outside of BC. So I get a great sense reading your book as to what New Brunswick is like, the public view of the Olin family.
Yeah, well, at least this part of New Brunswick, because, you know, as some of your audience may know, New Brunswick, although a small province, it has a large French population and so forth. But I try to concentrate in the area of St. John and Rosse. Rosse is a more upper-scale community where the Olins and many of their friends live. And I was born and raised in the area, so I bring a lot of that insider knowledge. And what I try to do is create a sort of atmosphere for people who may not know a lot about the area.
Yeah, and so this is a family, as I said in the introduction, that's second only to the Irvings and the McCains in terms of prominence, in terms of wealth, right?
Yeah, well, maybe not so much. It's complicated because, you know, as you find out in the book, the defendant, the convicted murderer, Dennis Olin, was part of that family, but he himself perhaps did not have the wealth. But it was more and his father certainly had wealth, but the victim had lost his direct ties with the Olin family, Moosehead Breweries, in the early 80s, but he sort of benefited from that connection. And so, the Moosehead Breweries, as people may know, is the largest independent brewery in Canada. It has roots in the 1860s in Halifax, and then a branch of the Olins came to St. John, New Brunswick during World War I and set up shop here.
Yeah, and Richard, the father of Dennis, he was quite prominent in business and in political circles, right?
Yes, well, I mean, as I put in the book, it's not often that you have a member of the Order of Canada, who's worth $35 million, being murdered in his office in a small city, right, where the crime rate is fairly low and it's considered fairly safe. So that's a bit of a shocker on many levels, right? And the fact that then the son, who's part of this network of families in Rosse and around St. John, was arrested for the murder of the father, that's the second shocker in the story.
And the murder of Richard Olin in 2011, that was quite a brutal murder, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, it was overkill, according to criminology specialists. He was hit on the head with a blunt and sharp object, never really determined in court, but I speculate it probably was a drywall hammer, 40 times. There were six defensive wounds to his hands where he tried to fend off the attacker, and there were like 12 or 13 wounds that penetrated the skull. There was a lot of blood. There was brain matter on the floor. And their pathologist concluded that he would have died almost instantly.
Hmm. And from the beginning, were there whispers as to how the police were investigating this thing? And I mean, the crime scene itself, right? There were questions.
Well, that didn't come out until the trial, actually. Mm-hmm. But I guess as you read the book, the one criticism in the community was how come it's taking so long to make an arrest, right? And then it's compounded by the other thing that's fascinating about this case is that the media outlets, CBC and Telegraph Journal, which is the Irving-owned newspaper, hired a prominent media lawyer from Halifax and applied to court to have aspects of the search warrants released to the public so they could publish them, mm-hmm. and before an arrest was made. So I call it almost like an act of legal striptease, you know, that the elements of the investigation are being revealed. The police don't want them revealed to the public before there is an arrest, right? Mm-hmm. So, but a lot of those examples of possible inadequate police investigation, such as not wearing gloves at the scene, such as contaminating a washroom that was outside the room where the murder victim was found, not checking a back door for fingerprints and DNA and that type of thing, that only came out during the trial. Of course, it was sort of sensational at the time.
Yeah. Were there any suspects other than Dennis?
None were ever identified, although the defense did sort of try to raise the issue of the husband of the mistress. This is another thing that was revealed before an arrest, that there was the murdered man, who was a prominent person. And as I put in my book, when you have money and connections in New Brunswick, you are shielded from a lot of prying eyes. There's kind of like a shield over you, right? And so this comes out into the media that the murdered man had a mistress. So, you know, the basic issue is that if someone's murdered, they have a mistress, the husband of the mistress is going to be a top suspect. He was raised as a possible suspect, and the defense tried to make something of that, but they couldn't really push it to the full extent. It's an issue they're still troubled by in terms of how that was handled by the court. And the gentleman in question was 83 years old at the time of the murder, Mr. Sedlicek. He was married to the mistress, Diana Sedlicek, who was a native St. Johner. They had met in Toronto, mm-hmm. and then retired here. And Mr. Sedlicek, when he came into court to testify for the Crown in 2011, was 87 years old.
Mm. Yeah, and so how long was it after the murder that I guess the police were focused on Dennis as a suspect?
Well, my reading is if you watch his police interview interrogation, which you can find on YouTube, by the way.
5 hours, right?
Yeah, but the part that was admissible was 2 hours and 22 minutes, because 2 hours and 22 minutes into the interview, he became a suspect and was told that and given his charter rights. They basically tell him he's a suspect. At 8:22 p.m. That evening, the father's body had been found at about 9 o'clock a.m. that morning. The family had only been told officially by the police at 2 p.m. because, they don't phone you. They come to your house, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Although the family had sort of inklings by 12:30 or 1, but the police came to the house in Rosse at 2 p.m. and asked the family members to come in and be interviewed. Typical, did your father have any enemies? What were his habits? That type of thing. Looking for suspects for leads. Dennis was the last family member to be interviewed that night, and he became probably in the second hour of his interview, he became a suspect, and then they officially declared him a suspect at 8:22. But then they let him go. They didn't arrest him. And they mm-hmm. didn't arrest him until November 2013.
So in the 2 years or so that he's out, I mean, yep. He's out and about. He's not hiding, or he didn't.
No. He's lost his job because of the notoriety. He's lost his job. He is trying to have a normal life, but there's a lot of gossip. Of course, once the search warrant information is revealed in stages through the media quest at court, you know, just before he's, you know, I think several months before he's arrested, it's revealed that the police consider him the suspect, right? And that money is a motive, and there might have been animosity over the father's affair. These are all things that the police had to put in their documents in order to convince a judge to issue a warrant. Mm-hmm. They have to have probable cause. So the police had to put all these sort of key elements of the case into these warrant requests, information to obtain, you know, within a few days of the murder. So early on, they had formulated their basic theory of the case.
And about the family dynamic, because Richard had, as you said already, a mistress. So relations with his wife and the three children. I guess Dennis was the youngest. What were they like over the years?
Well, it's hard to tell, but I mean, it seemed to be when there was outward calm and that type of thing. They were still married and lived in the same house, but Richard seemed to have another life. According to what his wife and daughters and Dennis's wife, Lisa, told the police officers that afternoon after the body was found, Richard was a difficult man. He had a short fuse. He was a control freak sort of guy with money. He was very judgmental and hard to deal with, particularly with his own family. And so, you know, that kind of fed the police perception of the father-son dynamic. The negativity seems to have been directed more from Richard towards other people. And but it turned out, you know, he's one of these people that was deemed to have a short fuse, mm-hmm. and not much of a filter.
And from your sense of it, I mean, in the video, in the video of the interrogation by police,
yep.
I mean, does it come out as to how, say, Dennis feels about his father?
Well, he seemed to have it could be interpreted as a negative view, but with a certain amount of understanding. He's trying to give the police officer that he felt that the father could be diagnosed with something, you know, that if it was a modern, you know, diagnosis of something. But it is a somewhat more negative view compared to when he testified in court in 2015. And in the book, I speculated that's why a jury may have found him not an overly credible witness, because the first view of his father when he talked to the police was a fairly negative view. And then when he testified in court, which is, again, is a risky move, in a second-degree murder trial to have the defendant testify, he portrayed a much more positive view of the father, right? So that seemed to be a disconnect there, and I infer that the jury probably made something of that.
Yeah, that video, because as you said earlier, you can find that on YouTube.
Yeah.
I watched a little bit of it.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating video.
It is, yeah.
And so from in the course of writing this book, I mean, you must have looked at that a few times.
Yes, I looked at it. I also consulted with a colleague who is a forensic psychologist who teaches with me at UMB St. John, and she's criminal justice and that type of thing. And she gave me some feedback on how the police are trained to conduct these interviews. So I talk about, you know, pro and con about that in the book. And the police, you know, a lot of people think that the police are, you know, doing something really over the top, but, you know, they're kind of trained to do it this way, right? But I also suggest that they're going on intuition a lot, you know, which is not necessarily scientific.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, this is just mere hours after they find the body, right?
Yeah, and for them to even, you know, again, as I'm not a police detective, but for them to tell a person that, you know, we know you did it, I mean, and then let them go, to me seems, I'm not sure what the point of that was, unless they're trying to just get a reaction from him. He does take his lawyer's advice, as I discussed in the book, for the most part, and doesn't respond after his rights are read, despite the fact that a more intense older officer, a very seasoned officer, has come in to do the bad cop routine with him. And you know, for 2 hours, it's pretty brutal to watch some of that stuff.
Yeah, indeed. So in the course of writing this book, who do you talk to, whether it's people who are involved in the case, detectives, say, lawyers, family even?
There is no contact there, because an appeal was underway, right? Mm. So when I was writing this, an appeal was underway, and just there was a time constraint. I talked to And also, as an academic, unlike a journalist or a freelancer, I have to go through research ethics when I mm-hmm. talk to people. So that creates another layer of bureaucracy. But I talked to some experts, a well-seasoned defense lawyer from New Brunswick who's been involved in 100 jury trials and 35 murder trials. I talked to my colleague, Professor Campbell, who works on credibility in forensic psychology. I talked to a law professor, Nicole O'Byrne from UNB Fredericton, who was also interviewed a lot because she teaches criminal law in Fredericton, right? And so yeah. She was a great resource. And then I just talked, just to get an overview of the St. John Police Force, he couldn't talk about the case. I talked to the new police chief. So those are the four people I interviewed. Otherwise, I just used court documents, transcripts. I looked at academic literature. I covered media. And then I just gleaned my knowledge of the justice system. You know, I teach criminal justice history, and my knowledge of St. John and having lived in the community as well. So, you know, it's not one of those books where you could interview people. They couldn't be interviewed anyway at this
yeah.
stage.
Yeah, because yeah. there's a second trial upcoming, and who knows? I mean, you're obviously going to be following that as well, right?
Yes, I was in Ottawa last week to follow the Supreme Court. This is another thing. The case makes history on this level that has triggered a Supreme Court examination of the issue of whether a convicted murderer who's applying on bail can be released. Who's flying up for an appeal can be released on bail. And actually, the Attorney General of British Columbia was one of the parties that sent lawyers to the hearing, right?
Yeah.
So it's of national importance now. It's never been done in New Brunswick. And lawyers argued that the New Brunswick Court of Appeal made a legal error by refusing to release their client when he had applied for an appeal. Now, he's, by virtue of the New Brunswick Court of Appeal decision a couple of weeks ago, he was not acquitted, but, you know, his conviction was quashed, so he has a presumption of innocence, sort of, and now he was released on bail anyway. But it's interesting that Dennis and his wife and his family were still in Ottawa last Monday to attend the Supreme Court of Canada hearing.
Yeah, so this case, I mean, other than, say, a sensational case as it is, has legal implications across this country, doesn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, it's triggered. I mean, it would have happened anyway, but again, I think that was surprising that the Supreme Court, we only heard in late June that the Supreme Court agreed to hear the bail issue, and of course the point became moot when Dennis was released by the New Brunswick Court of Appeal in late October. You know, it made legal history in other ways as well. It has the largest jury pool in Canadian history. 5,000 people were called, right? And just recently there was a murder trial in Moncton, very bloody, where a young man was stabbed to death, and I think they called 600 for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, the media attention, the connections. A lot of people have worked for Moosehead. They've socialized with the Olins. The Olins have been involved in community efforts, fundraising efforts, right? And So it also made history in that in New Brunswick, the Court of Appeal did live streaming of the appeal. That hadn't happened before, right? So there's a number of areas in which this made sort of legal history either within the province and now with the Supreme Court issue, it's making history nationally.
Yeah, so the first trial where he's found guilty, he's convicted, and now that conviction has been quashed. What's the appeals court, what did they cite in terms of the mistakes of the first trial?
Well, the appellant listed 8 grounds of appeal, and some of them had to do with they objected to evidence that the trial judge admitted and also the charge to the jury. But in the end, there was one of the 8 grounds, which was part of the judge's charge to the jury, that they found the judge had not been careful enough on an issue of something that's called post-offense conduct, and there's case law on this. And so the issue was not whether or not Dennis was innocent or guilty, but whether or not he got a fair trial.
Mm.
And in the end, the 3 justices ruled that he did not get a fair trial because Justice Walsh, the trial judge, failed to give a proper instruction. And it's a very tricky point of law that I, as a non-law professor, still have a hard time understanding, but it was about Dennis, when he was interviewed in that interview we just talked about, he told the police he wore a blue blazer the day of the murder. Well, by surveillance video and talking to other people, it was deemed that he wore a brown blazer. So that's important for 2 reasons. First of all, he could be seen as lying about what color jacket he wore in order to cover up a crime. Secondly, the brown blazer, as people may know, was later found to have 4 specks of the victim's DNA on it. And that became a leading piece of forensic evidence in the conviction, so much so that the defense tried to have that thrown out.
Yeah.
Right. The appeal court would not throw that out, but they went back to this post-offense conduct, which was the statement about the blue blazer. And apparently there's case law that says if someone is seen to be making a possible lie, there has to be independent evidence about what that lie means. Otherwise, the judge has to make a special instruction to the jury. And a lawyer explained it this way to me. I could tell you I wore a blue blazer, but the reason I told you that is not because I killed my father. It's because I stole that blazer, or that my mistress gave me that blazer, or whatever. You know, so it doesn't have to relate to the actual link to a possible crime. Again, it's a very hard, it's a very subtle argument for, you know, a layperson to understand, but there's case law there, and it was enough to overturn the conviction.
So this jacket, this brown jacket in question that had the specks of blood on it.
There was blood? Yeah, it's complicated, yeah, because, yeah.
Is that identified? I mean, I don't know much about DNA now.
Yeah.
Is that clearly identified as Richard's blood or,
yes.
or even his?
Not the blood. No, it's settled because the judge in his instructions to the jury had to be fair to the case law and said, look, there are three little small spots of blood on the blazer. They were not visible to the human eye. So the defense would say, well, how could he go in and kill his dad with a drywall hammer or a hatchet and not have blood splatter back on the jacket?
Yeah.
Instead, what you had, these little micro spots. Within that blood, there is the victim's DNA. There's also a fourth spot that's not in blood, that's the DNA. So the defense's view was that, well, you haven't proven that the DNA is in the blood. The Crown's view, well, we think it's the blood that contains the DNA, right? So, but that provides that, you know, that, you know, you talk about motive, opportunity, and method. The blood or DNA on the Hugo Boss brown jacket supports method. You know, that some sort of bludgeoning took place, and the DNA and the blood were transferred. Now, if you read the book, you'll also find out the other complicating issue is that Dennis leaves the police headquarters at 11 o'clock that night after his interrogation. At 9 o'clock the next morning, someone takes the brown jacket to be dry cleaned in Rosse. And it was never determined who dropped it off, who in the family. So again, that's another aspect of post-defense conduct. Why was the brown jacket that he lied about, that was later determined to have the victim's DNA on it, taken to dry cleaning? The defense had a logical explanation to that he needed that jacket to go to his father's funeral. But again, it's one of those key pieces of circumstantial evidence that I think the jury used to convict Mr. Olin.
Did you get a sense of who the jury was?
Well, there's privacy, as you understand,
but
St. John's a small place. I knew of one, not that well, and then along the way you find out about others, but you kind of give them their privacy, and you don't even want to know their name, sort of thing. But they were drawn from, I think it was 8 men and 4 women at the end, and they were drawn from St. John and Kings Counties, which together have only 140,000 people of all ages, right? So, so the question arises, I think they will be able to do it, but the question arises, what happens when they go for trial number 2? How will they get a jury, right?
So everybody at this point has heard about it, right?
Well, maybe, but yeah. I mean, a lot of people certainly knew, because I talk about the level of gossip and speculation in the community, too, in the book, and a lot of people certainly were talking about it in 2015 when the trial was started, and they called 5,000 people. 1,100 of them did not get exemptions, and they were organized in batches to go to the courthouse for selection, and it only took them 2 days, and they probably went through fewer than 200 people. Right, so it's not as scientific as you see in the U.S. shows about, you know, jury consultants and things like that, right? So I think they could do it, or they could transfer to another jurisdiction like Moncton or someplace where, although it's in New Brunswick, you're just a little more distant. You know, people in Moncton, which is only an hour and a half away, are less likely to have worked for Moosehead or to have socialized with the victim or the defendant and that type of thing, right? So even within a small province, it would be possible, if they needed to get a change of venue.
I remember seeing news reports last week about all of this, and you know, the one of the stations, I can't remember which one it was, had a camera on the street and asking people on the street what they thought. And I remember one comment in particular that struck with me as I was reading your book, and it was a lady who said, you know, this is costing the taxpayers a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I mean, that must be something, a common feeling. I mean, not a prevalent feeling, but certainly some people think that in St. John.
Well, actually, it was raised by the Court of Appeal, because I think it's something that the judges at appeal courts are entitled to raise, and they wanted to know, or, you know, when the Crown was objecting to the, when the Crown, you know, was fighting the appeal, Chief Justice said, what about the cost? And I don't think then the Crown attorney couldn't go around and say, well, you know, this is too costly, we can't have another trial, but apparently these things are discussed. Now, what about the other side? Who's paying for the Olin defense?
Mm.
Right? I raise that in the book. This is costing millions. Right, we're not quite clear who's paying for it, but when Richard passed away, his wife received his fortune in a trust fund. She can use the interest and 35 or 36 million, and can also dip into it under certain circumstances. The other possible avenue or combination is Uncle Derek, who was the former head and chief. Sole shareholder in Moosehead, right? He may have money. Who knows? The Moosehead and the Irving companies and that type of thing. These family-owned companies, they don't have shareholders as we would know them, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's all kind of privately held, right? So that's, you know. But yeah, that is an issue. But I think there would be a hue and cry if the Crown decided, for financial reasons, not to fight this case, because, you know, a man was murdered,
mm-hmm.
right? And one jury has already convicted.
Yeah.
Right, and but I haven't heard much discussion on that. But there's a lot of fatalism as well about, you know, wealth buys you protection in the legal system, but look at the outcome
in
the jury trial, right?
Yeah.
So,
what's your sense in terms of how long we've got until the second trial starts?
Well, a defendant can waive the right to a preliminary inquiry. I doubt that this legal team would do that, but I don't think they'd be able to mount the fight against evidence that they mounted in 2015. As I explained in the book, there were a series of voir dires, which are kind of mini trials within a trial before the trial starts, about the admission of evidence. And, you know, I mean, I could be wrong, but my understanding is now that the Court of Appeal has struck down those grounds of appeal, it would be very difficult for the defense team to turn around and try again to get certain things excluded. Right, so that would save some time, because that took the better part of a year, at least several months. I think the clerk of the court was quoted in the paper saying that the earliest in theory for a trial could be next fall.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and but again, if you look at the length of time it took last time, Richard was murdered in July of 2011, and the trial didn't end to December 2015. Right. And I don't know. There's certainly, I'm going to follow the case as if there's another book. There's another trial. So I have to keep doing the research. I haven't come this far. Right. So,
yeah. So, I mean, you've looked at everything. You've looked at transcripts. You've talked to the people. I mean, you've said already that the people that you've talked to. What's your gut sense say as to what happened here and, you know, what Dennis's role in all of this is?
I can't give that away. That's the kernel of my book. I've broken the fundamental rule of academic writing and true crime writing. I do not have a conclusion, and I'm leaving it. If you look at that last chapter, I throw it back at the reader. Right now, I try to infer though why the jury came to its decision. Right.
Yeah.
But I look at those key issues like the back door, the victim's missing iPhone, the lack of a weapon, the blood evidence, the motive, you know, all those sort of key issues. There's seven or eight key issues in the case. The timeline of the crime, from both, you know, if Dennis is innocent or if Dennis is guilty. You know, I try to look at those different scenarios. But in the end, I've come with a different type of ending. I'm not having a conclusion from me. You have to, as a reader, come to your own conclusion. It's very interesting. I've already had a couple of messages from readers one person typed up a little summary of what they thought happened, that's the sort of thing I want to sort of, you know, get going with people.
I mean, are you not telling me because you don't have one, or, I mean, because I can also see how, having seen everything, Yeah. It can possibly, you may not want to jump to any conclusions.
Yeah. Well, I will say what I said at the outlet. I was in the media being shocked at the verdict back in on December 19th, but in the book I try to go back and unpack that and try to understand why the jury may have, and what was it I was missing, perhaps, someone who sat in court. Again, it's the first jury trial I've ever sat in on. I've read about others. I've studied them in the past. So, it was no secret my feelings at the time, kind of a gut reaction, partly because I just thought the defense was so strong and there was the issue of reasonable doubt. But in the book, again, I'm inviting the reader to go back and I'm trying to offer some suggestions as what was it that may have triggered the jury to come down the way it did, right? Yeah. And ultimately, we'll never know because under the criminal code, they can't discuss, the nature of their decisions, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to talk in a couple of years.
Yeah.
and see, perhaps there'll be a closure then, and then we can really get into it as to what we think, right?
That's right. Book number two.
Indeed. Greg, such a fascinating book, and it's tough to put down. We'll be following your work as this literally new chapter unfolds.
Yeah, I really appreciate your interest. Thanks.
Good luck with it.
Thanks.
The book is called Truth and Honor, The Death of Richard Olin and the Trial of Dennis Olin. It's from Nimbus Publishing. It's author Greg Marquis. Join me on the line from St. John, New Brunswick in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.